We're here to commemorate the memory of a very, very special person. And this is our annual Dr. Abraham Weissman Shir lecture that we've been observing in our yeshiva for the last several years. And we're very pleased to have the daughter of Dr. Weissman present with us today, Evelyn Biar, and also other members of the Weissman family and friends of the family who have joined us today as well. Bishus, Rabbi Chalap, and Rabbi Fulda, Rabbi Cohn, and Rabbi Bronstein. It's a very special schus to have such a wonderful smicha group of students where every single year it's not difficult for us to find somebody who's both a member of our kollel, a member of our smicha program, and also somebody who is going for a medical degree, who is able to represent the ideals of Torah and medicine that were represented so majestically by Dr. Weissman. Dr. Weissman served as a family practitioner in Washington Heights for about 60 years. He was a doctor. I feel like this microphone is about to fall at any moment. If it does, so okay. He was a doctor who treated both Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal. He also treated the Panovich Arav. I gather that the Panovich Arav maybe traveled to America for health reasons at various points in time. And Dr. Weissman was just known for his tremendous chesed, his tremendous medical ability, and his tremendous commitment to Torah ideals in terms of everything that he did. We read in this past week's parsha, in Parshas Behaloscha, that when Miriam, the sister of Moshe Rabbeinu, was afflicted with saras, so Moshe turned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a plea of a prayer. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, perhaps one of the original formulations of a bracha for a refuah, Moshe Rabbeinu said five pithy words. He said, Kel na refa na la. He said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we prayed, begged, the word na, lashon bakasha, please heal her. Please heal my sister. Told that Moshe Rabbeinu articulated a tefillah ketzarah, that it was a shortened, truncated tefillah, that nobody should feel that he wasn't giving adequate attention to the other needs of the tzibor, and nobody should feel that he was taking too much time just to pray for a member of his family at the expense of everybody else. But in truth, if you look at the wording, it is an exquisite expression of what a tefillah for refuah is all about, which is something that is clear, something which is pithy, something which is direct, and something which is directed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with an appreciation of Ki Ani Hashem Rofecha, that ultimately the true Rofe Cholim is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And whatever efforts we're going to expend, they're only successful by the grace of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the commentator, the Sifsei Kohen, says that the repetition of the word Na, which appears twice in the phrase Kel Na Refa Na La, so he explains that one of the Na's was to provide for Refua Shlema, that Miriam should have a full recovery from whatever it was that ailed her. But the other Na was inserted because when we pray for a Refua, it's a prayer not only that the person be healed, but that they should be healed immediately. That it should be a refuah shlema bimheira. And this is the prayer, according to the Sifsei Kohen, which serves as the origin for our standard articulation, that we pray that somebody should have a refuah shlema bimheira. So there is really both what I would call an imminence and an immanence. Imminence with an I and immanence with an A. a sense that when we deal with matters of refuah, it's something which has immediate significance, and also a sense of immanence, that it's something which is directly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence resides within any enterprise of refuah. So this awareness of the essential urgency of the refuah process, as well as its dependence upon HaKadosh Baruch Hu, was something that was truly epitomized by Dr. Weissman, and something which is appreciated by those of our Talmidim who are zoche both to learn Ben Kosle Yeshivatenu and also prepare for a career in medicine. Yonah Bardos is a sterling example of this exemplary combination of attributes. Yonah, when he was still a student in his college years at our yeshiva, after having learned in Keren B'Yavneh for a couple of years, he was also a graduate of Ner Yisrael High School. So Yonah was the president of the Medical Ethics Society. And when he met with our Bochen, when he became a student, it was noted that he had particular interest in medical halacha. And the Bochen noted, I don't know if I'm supposed to disclose this kind of, you know, classified information. According to the words of the Bochen, this is what he likes and is very good at. So we'll be able to witness some of that expertise in today's lecture. Please let this be my child. Ovarian transplants and maternity in Jewish law, a new approach in which our speaker will deal with new challenges in medicine with this combination of alacrity and Yiras Shemayim that we are celebrating today with the tribute to the memory of Dr. Weissman. Just before I call up our speaker, I want to also give special Hakaras HaTov to two individuals. One who couldn't be with here today and one who is here. The one who couldn't be here today is Dr. Herbert Dobrinsky, who had to be at another important board of trustees meeting for the yeshiva, but who really wanted to be here. Dr. Dobrinsky has certainly developed over the years a close relationship with the family, as a deep appreciation of Dr. Weissman, and was a key player in putting together this memorial lecture series. His presence is missed, but his contribution is very much appreciated as always. And the other Hakara Satov that I wanted to give is to Janine Kay, who works for our development department, who really worked mightily to coordinate every single detail of today's event, including the collation, which has been set up outside on the second floor, that we ask everybody to partake of for a tikkun of the neshama. We very much appreciate all of Janine's efforts. And without further ado, it's now my pleasure to call upon Yonah Bardos.
Thank you, Rabbi Reese, for those very kind words, some of which are actually true. Bishus to Rosh Yeshiva, the esteemed Kol members, Dr. Weissman's family, and my father. I was asked to give a shiur today in the memory of Dr. Weissman. And as Rabbi Reese mentioned, Dr. Weissman was a physician here in Washington Heights for almost six decades. He also treated many of the Gedolei Hador, like the Rav and the Panovitcher Rav. And he served the YU student community. And from what I've been told about Dr. Weissman, he was very compassionate and caring about his patients. That was something that was very important to him. And I feel that this shiur will reflect that midah of Dr. Weissman. This shiur came about, I think, from a compassion when I was seeing my patients, when I was seeing some challenges, and I delved a little further into the matter. So, as Rabbi Reese mentioned, we're going to be speaking about Please Let This Be My Child, Ovarian Transplants and Maternity in Jewish Law. So, in every good lecture that I've ever been to in medical school, we always did start with a couple case studies. Now, the reason why I like to start with case studies is that I find that it gives us a little bit of a face to who we're talking about and helps us look back as we're going through and refer back. So let's start with the first case. First case is Chana. Chana is a 24-year-old who suffered from leukemia as a young child. Her treatment, while successful and life-saving, unfortunately left her infertile. Doctors have told her over the years that she will never be able to have a child of her own, something that is very hard for anyone to ever hear. So she's now happily married, and she wants to have a child that she can call her own. She goes in to meet with her doctor, and the doctor says to her, well, you can use something called egg donation. So the first question that we have is, from a Jewish perspective, when you use egg donation, will Chana be able to call the resulting child her own? In the second case, which is about a twist on the first case, and something that only could have possibly been within the realm of existence a mere few months ago. What if instead the doctors turned to Chana and said, I have a brand new cutting-edge treatment for you called ovarian stem cell transplant. I have something called ovarian stem cells. I'd like to transplant that. In that case, would Chana be able to call that child her own? In both of these cases, Chana desperately wants to be the mother of the resulting child. And the question that we have is, how can a halacha respond to this desperate plea of a mother? So the usual halachic discussion regarding maternity in egg donation in Jewish law is usually centered around genetics versus birth. The two camps are always, that's always discussed, is it the genetic parent that conveys parenthood, or is it the birth mother that is considered the parent? And today I would like to discuss something, a third possible dimension, one that I've actually never seen discussed in this manner, and see if that in fact would apply in this case. And in order to appreciate that, what we'll do throughout this year is first we'll talk a little bit about egg donation, then we'll refer to ovarian transplant literature, which is where some of the egg donation literature comes from. We'll talk a little bit about the medicine, the science, the bioethical background, as well as the halacha. So let's first begin shortly with egg donation. So egg donation is something that only first became a reality in 1984. UCLA in 1984 was the first reported live birth of someone of an egg donor. So it's important to note that because that's only around the mid-1980s is when we first start seeing tshuvos written about it. And so how do we do egg donation? How is egg donation done? So this you can turn to your handout. You see in the top right picture, we have some beautiful color handouts. Basically, what's done is the woman comes into the doctor's office. She's given certain hormones over a period of time. What those hormones do is they make her ovaries super ovulate, basically make grow a lot of eggs. We then go in, we retrieve those eggs. We mix the eggs together with the man's sperm in the laboratory. We grow it into an embryo, and at the right time, a few days later, we put it back inside the woman. So that's how it's done. But why is it done? Who gets egg donations? So essentially, the people that receive egg donations are people that are having trouble conceiving. And there's two general categories of people who have trouble conceiving. The first is for people that don't have eggs. So they have the ability to carry a pregnancy, but unfortunately they don't have eggs. So this could be our case like Chana, someone whose ovaries were destroyed in a chemotherapy treatment. Or it could be a case of someone who had something called premature ovarian failure, where her ovaries unfortunately stopped working much earlier on than the usual life cycle. That's the first case. So that's a woman who could carry a pregnancy, but she doesn't have eggs, in which case she would need someone to donate their eggs to her for her to have carry a pregnancy. The second case is someone who has eggs, but can't actually carry the pregnancy for whatever reason. It could be she doesn't have a uterus. It could be that she's tried many times, and for whatever reason, the body has rejected her, and she's had multiple miscarriages. So that's a situation where she has her own eggs, but she can't carry the pregnancy to term. So she would need someone else. In a sense, she'd be donating her eggs to another woman to carry the pregnancy for her. Okay. Now, because in 1984 was really the first time that this started, so there never was a halachic discussion before this of egg donation. But what did exist prior to this was a discussion of ovarian transplants. An ovarian transplant is something that's both cutting edge and a part of medical history. In fact, it's something that's making the news now in 2012 and also made the news in 1895. And as fanciful as this sounds, is ovarian transplant actually done? And the answer is not so much. There are only a few reported cases of recent, and you can see here actually in your handout, New England Journal of Medicine in 2007, where they did a successful ovarian transplant. But for the most part, it's not actually done. And part of that is because egg donation, it wasn't very successful in the beginning. There were a lot of complications with it. And egg donation using IVF was actually much more successful. In truth, most of current use of ovarian transplant is for fertility preservation, something which we can talk about at a different time. But with regular ovarian transplant, what's actually happening? So you can see here there's a picture below the New England Journal of Medicine. There's another beautiful color picture. So what actually happens is we take a piece of one woman's tissue. So this is tissue that actually contains the follicles and the eggs of one woman, and we're transplanting those pre-made follicles into another woman. But what about, and some might say in that case, that we are transplanting essentially another woman's eggs, which is another woman's genetics. And they would say, therefore, in this case, it should be the genetic parent, the person from whom the eggs came from, that's the parent. But what about if I told you about ovarian stem cells? If you take a look here on the middle of the page, there was a breakthrough in February 26, 2012. And what researchers found was that something that went against what was the current medical knowledge for quite some time. It was always thought that a woman was born with all of the eggs she was going to have her entire life. That at the beginning, and then as immediately from birth, all the way until menopause, she would lose her eggs. Researchers in Mass General and in Japan discovered that that might not be true. That in fact, they found stem cells in the ovaries that actually make the follicles that make the eggs. And they were able to grow immature follicles that can then grow eggs. So what about now, if I ask you, if you're now transplanting, now a giant step earlier, before we were transplanting another woman's eggs, but now, what if I transplant stem cells? In that case, what would halacha say? And I think that this is too new, so there's nothing out on that. But it's something that I hope that we'll be able to answer in the future. But as I mentioned, some of the basis for the egg donation literature comes from ovarian transplants. And where does that halakhic literature come from? So on the one hand, this is something that's incredibly novel, something that's making the news only a few months ago. And on the other hand, this is something that was actually first performed in 1895. And at the time in 1895, there were no successful births. However, in 1902, a doctor by the name of Dr. Robert Morris made a medical history when he removed one woman's ovaries and he placed indeed in the first recorded ovarian transplant that resulted in a live birth. And as you can see here in the medical record, in the bottom left corner, in 1906, Dr. Robert Morris's patient gave birth to the first live child from an ovarian transplant. Now what's fascinating at the time is that there was a discussion in the medical literature about A, whether in fact he had actually done this, some people didn't believe it, and B, who would be the mother of the child. And there were three fascinating ideas that were floated in the medical literature at the time. And the first was, they said that it should be the ovary donor, the woman from whom the eggs came from. Now, at this point, they didn't necessarily know what eggs did, but they knew eggs existed. They assumed it had something to do with the pregnancy and the resulting child, but they weren't sure exactly all of its connection. So they said that it should be the genetics. It should be whoever owns the eggs. The second perspective said, no, it should be the birth woman. And they said that once the eggs are removed from the first woman's body, it's as if it's nothing. And remember that, because we're going to come to that in the halakhic literature. They say basically it's as if it's bottle. It's as if we completely forget about the first woman, and it becomes completely embedded into the second one. And the third one, which I find very interesting, and you can see how much they understood about genetics, is they said, well, why don't you just wait until the child's born? Take a look at who the child looks like. Now, if anyone's been around usually in the first couple of weeks of a child's birth, after they're born, you'll probably realize that every day, depending on which side of the family you ask, you'll get a very different answer to that question. So that probably wasn't the best idea. But you see this discussion that exists in that literature. And due to this medical breakthrough in 1906, so in 1907, it hit the halachic journals. If you turn your page, the journal, Hungarian journal Vayalekit Yosef, this is a Hungarian journal that would that discussed some halachic issues at the time, and the editor, Rabbi Gordon, he posed this question to his readers, and I'll read it with you because it's a fascinating question. And he says, "Atzia b'zeh she'ilash nesapati lahalacha." I have a question for you guys. Harofim himtziu potas bula lahoshiv klei beidin meisha. Doctors seem to be able to do something that he calls lahoshiv klei leida meisha, to remove and replace the klei leida of an isha. And I'm not going to translate that for a second. And he says, "Beisha akara," with a woman who's barren, and then tuchal laholish, she can then give birth. So he asks, "Mutter, is someone able to do this?" And if you skip down to the next underlined line, "Uvechlal mihi ha'in." So now, for the first time, we see in the halachic literature, they're asking who would be the mother in this case. Would it be the first one or the second one? He says, "Ha'isha echad or ha'isha hashniyah." And he says, "Amarti." Therefore, I felt lishol zos bivialeket Yosef umi yodea peta daver. He says, "Does anyone have an idea? It's never been discussed before. It's never existed before. What would be the halacha?" And the reason, so I didn't translate the words lahoshiv klei leida meisha. That was the limit. Because I'm fairly certain if I went around to this room and I asked each and every one of you, translate the words klei leida, I would get many different responses. And that's exactly what happened. This ambiguous question, when he sent it out, he got wildly differing responses in the understanding of what the shaila was. In fact, one rabbi even wrote back and he thought that klei leida meant including the external genitalia. Therefore, he has a whole discussion about whether it would be considered erva in this case for that woman to be with her husband. Obviously, that's not what happened. But this does highlight one of the ideas that it's important to understand what was happening in the medical, historical, and halachic background at the time when you're reading a tshuva. To always know what was the current medical knowledge, what were they thinking at the time, what were they responding to, what was the case they were talking about, and what did they think was going on. So the answer that that I will discuss with you a little bit more is from the Evan Yekara. Evan Yekara wrote a few years later on the same question. And he actually answers the question. And he says, if you skip down to the second underlined line, "Ki ani rachok libi lahamin." First of all, he says, "I don't believe this actually happened." But he says, "Let's say it did." So he says, "Ach." So then he wants to know, if you skip down to the next underlined line, so, is it the hayeled hu ben shel hashnia? So who would it belong to? And he answers, "Hayeled hu ben shel hashnia." He says it would belong to the birth mother, lekol davar. Where does he get this from? Right, this has never been discussed before in the halachic literature. So where is he going? Where is he getting this from? So he had to circle far and wide in Shas and look for a possible source for this answer. What's the source that he brings? V'amakor haneftach la'alacha zula niyastaiti hu adin amavor b'shas. He says, this is something that I learned in the Gemara in Sota. Yolda she'simcha v'zekeinu le'inyin arla. Agricultural law. He found a source to this answer, this perplexing human question in agricultural law. What was the agricultural law? So if you look to your left, so the Gemara in Sota, what was the Gemara in Sota talking about? Gemara in Sota is talking about a person. So we have a din called arla. Basically what that means is for the first 4 years after I plant a brand new fruit tree, I can't eat any of the fruit from that tree. But what about if I became creative and I broke off a branch from my young tree and I grafted that onto an old tree? And then that branch on the old tree, now this young tree that I just grafted on, that now grows fruit. So in that case, would I be able to eat that fruit? Is that fruit still of a din of arla? Do we still go from its original place? Or do we say, no, it all belongs completely to its new home? And the answer there is that no, batli yad lizakeinu, we would say it belongs to its new home. And that is where the Evan Yekara says, therefore, an ovarian transplant is the same thing. I took it out from the old home, I put it in the new home, we forget about the original place, and we go with the new home. Now there's a whole discussion about whether you can even apply agricultural law to trying to make this decision, but that's neither here nor there. But the point is that we start seeing this discussion of the idea of an ovarian transplant, or the idea that you could have Is it the genetics or is it the birth? So now, coming back to Chana, what would we tell Chana? When Chana comes to you, and many of you are going to be, I'm sure, Gedolei Yisrael, you're sitting in the kollel, you're learning all day. Chana's going to come to you. She's going to come on your doorstep and she's going to ask you this question. So what would you answer to her? So she'll come to you. She's not going to ask you about ovarian transplants, because that's not done so much, but she's going to ask you about the egg donation. And she's going to want to know, is this my child? Can I call the resulting child after I do this my child? And you're going to look into her eyes and you're going to see that plea, and you're going to want to know what the answer is. Okay, so what's the answer? So, first question I had was, is there any place in the Torah where we might see an answer to this question? Now again, remember, this was never discussed before in the postgame, this was never discussed in the Rishonim, Nachronim, no one ever talked about egg donation. So when this question first fell on the doorsteps of the Gedolei Yisrael, they needed to have Shas at their fingertips. They needed to have Kol Torah Kula, all the Torah, at their fingertips to be able to find a case that is analogous. Because you need to find a case, you can't search Bar Ilan or anything like that for egg donation, that's not going to come up. So you need to know everything and try to say, okay, what's a case that might be analogous, that might show me a situation like this? So the first source in the Torah is a fascinating source. So the Psukim and Bereishis are talking about the Shvatim. And they're listing all the Shvatim, how many Shvatim came from Leah. And the Torah uses a pattern. It uses the words Vataher Vatelin. It says basically she conceived, then she gave birth. She conceived to this one, then she gave birth. And all of a sudden, the Torah changes. And the Torah says, Va'achar yolda bas v'tikra shema dina. It removes the fact that she conceived. So the discussion on that spot is why. Why did the Torah deviate from its usual pattern? So there's a fascinating Targum Yonasan. Targum Yonasan discusses the case. He says, well, what was happening was Rachel and Leah were both pregnant at the same time. And at this point, 10 Shvatim were born, and they all knew that there were only going to be 12 Shvatim. And Leah realized, if I'm pregnant with a boy, and Rachel's pregnant with a boy, Rachel will only have one Shevet that she'll be able to contribute to Klai Yisrael. And the maidservants, they each contributed two. So she dove into HaKadosh Baruch Hu and cried out to Hashem. Now listen to what the Targum Yonasan says happened. So the underlying words in the bottom right hand of your page, Ushmayim in Kadam Hashem Tzelusa Delea, Hashem heard it. And what did he do? The Ischalfu Uvarya B'me'ehom. And he switched the fetus. The fetus that was originally in Leah, he switched V'Havi Yohev Yosef V'Masa D'Rach and placed Yosef, who according to this Medrash, according to this understand this version of Targum Yonasan, he actually switched Yosef that was originally in Leah and switched it into Rachel. Now, if I ask each and every one of you who is considered the mother of Yosef, I think most of you would say Rachel, hopefully. But based on this Targum Yonasan, who is the genetic mother? Right? The genetic mother is Leah. But clearly the Torah seems to imply, the Torah implies, and what we all think, is that the mother is in fact Rachel. This would seem to be a proof that it is the birth mother and not the genetic mother. There are a couple of problems with this, though. First is that it's a medrash, and we usually try not to use medrashim when we pass the halacha. It's also an alternative text of the Targum Yonasan. That's another issue. And the third issue is the fact that the same story is brought down in the Gemara and Brachos and has a different outcome. And usually when we have a medrash and we have a similar story in the Gemara with a different outcome, we don't follow that medrash. What did the Gemara in Brachos say? That's the famous, I believe Rashi brings it down, that actually what happened was this Leah davened, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu just switched the sex of the child. So that's why it says, Vatikra Shemadina. It was because it was originally was a male, they became a female. Simple as that. Okay. But we at least have the beginnings of an idea of where we would find this discussion of birth versus genetics. What about in the Gemara? Is there any place in the Gemara? Now again, like I said, when you're looking through the Gemara and you're searching through the Gemara for an analogous case, you need to have Shas at your fingertips. Because there is going to be a case that talks about Eichnerish. So is there a case in the Gemara that we can find in which we have a separation, a technical separation, a halachic separation between the mother who conceived, the genetic mother, and the mother who gives birth, the birth mother? And the yeshiva is learning Yevamos this year. So there's two sugyas in Yevamos that it's possible to take out from those sugyas each one of these views. So you turn to page 3, at the top of page 3. So the first one is the Gemara in Yevamos Daf Tzadi Zayin. And the Gemara here is Tashma, Te Shnei Achem Te'umim Gerim. It's talking about two twins who converted. And these are twins who are obviously, if they're twins, they have to be brothers from both the mother and the father. And normally we have a halacha that says that brothers cannot marry their brother's ex-wife. So the Gemara says, but in this case, if you have twins who were brothers but then converted, so the second line, the underlying line, Ein chayav mishum eshesach. There's no isur midaraisa for them to marry their brother's ex-wife. If you look on the next Rashi right below that, Rashi says, why is this? It says, the ger sheniskayer kekatan shenoladam. Very simply, when a ger is megayer, all of his genetic relationships are severed. It's as if he's a new person. Hilkach ein lo achua afilu me'ein. Therefore, he has no brothers. He's lost all relationships with his father, with his mother, with any brothers that he had. And therefore, midaraisa, there would be no problem for him to marry his brother's ex-wife. However, the Gemara goes on and says, Haisa hayrasan shelo b'kedusha. But what if he was conceived as a guy? So these brothers were conceived as a guy. V'leidasan b'kedusha. And they were born now, their mother converted in the middle. What would be the din in that case? And what does the Gemara say? Chayavin mishon eshes ach. So that would be illegal for them to marry. What does Rashi say? Why is that true? What changed? Why is this any different than the previous case that we just saw? So Rashi says, Avo chayavin, it's the second, Rashi down there, it's the second line down, second to last line, underlying line. He says at the end of the line, Shaharihi ki Yisraelis sheyel debana. And the reason why is because she gave birth, she was the Yisraelis who gave birth to these sons. And this would seem to imply what? That the maternal halacha connection does not begin at conception, it does not begin with genetics, but in fact it begins with birth. Birth seems to create a maternal halacha connection. That would be the implication from this Gemara. Remember, the Gemara does not talk about egg donation, so this is an implication from the understanding of the Gemara. And obviously there are other different ways to understand this Gemara, depending on the Rishonim that you look at. There's a second Gemara that seems to imply the opposite. And this is the Gemara in Yevamos as well, on Daf Ayin Ches. And here the Gemara is talking about a pregnant woman who converts. So similar case, no brothers. And the question is, does the son, when her child is born, does that child require a tefillah? Do they have to go to the mikveh? And the Gemara says, no. The Gemara says, v'na ein tzarif tefillah. Doesn't require to go to the mikveh. The Gemara asks, am I ein tzarif tefillah? Why doesn't this child need a tefillah? Right? The child was conceived as a guy. Why doesn't this child need a tefillah? So what would be the answer you would give? After having just read Rashi in the last Gemara, what would be the simple answer you would give? He was born to a Jew. Rashi said it. He's born to a Jew. That's the reason why he doesn't need a tefillah. What does the Gemara answer? So the Gemara goes through a whole discussion about maybe the reason why, it's technical reason. It's because, in fact, the ubar was inside, and the mother's body is not considered a chatzitza. It's not a barrier for the tefillah. And the Gemara ultimately says, Shani Uber Dehainu Revise, that the reason why the child does not require a tefillah is because it was the natural way in which it... That was the natural way in which it grows. Therefore, the Gemara's body is not a chatzitza. So what would seem to imply from the Gemara's answer is the Gemara could have given the simple answer, the answer that the reason why the child doesn't require a tefillah is because the child's Jewish, it was born to a Jewish mother. From the fact that the Gemara does not give that answer, an implication could be that no, it goes after the genetics. that really the child needs its own tevila. Because it was conceived, when it was conceived, it was not Jewish. The fact that it was born to a Jewish mother is irrelevant. So this Gemara would seem to imply that it's part, that it's the genetics that is koveya, the parenthood. So what we see here is two Gemaras that seem to imply, one, that it's the birth mother that's the mother, and one, that it's the genetic mother that's the mother. Okay. But at the end of the day, coming back to Chana, when Chana comes to you and says, and she's going to, if you ask your abundant in the field, they will tell you this is questions that they get. So when Chana comes to you and says, is this my child? Halachically, can I call this child my child? What are you going to answer her? We have two warring opinions. We have there's no concrete sources. And you have many poskim, gedolei poskim, on both sides of the issue. And this bothered me. When I first had given the shiur at Einstein, It bothered me that at the end of the day, depending on who Chana asked, might depend on whether this child is hers. And I didn't really know what to do with it, mainly because this is the halacha, and halacha is the halacha, and you can't, just because you don't like something doesn't mean that's not halacha anymore. You have to follow what the halacha says. And that was where I left it. I had no idea where to go from there. And I was sitting in my reproductive ethics class this past year, and in reproductive ethics, we were talking about a fascinating case. The case is called the Bezenkas. And the case of the five-partner child. What is the five-partner child? So essentially, Mr. and Mrs. Bezenka, they wanted to have a child. But they were unable to. They didn't have, for whatever reason, they couldn't donate the sperm or the eggs. So what they did is they found the sperm donor, they found an egg donor, and they found even someone to carry the child. They got everything together. The surrogate mother, the surrogate carrier was pregnant. About 5 months in, Mr. Bezenka files for divorce. And in his divorce filing, he says, I have no children. No children from this marriage. I'm not responsible for anything. He says, my wife's not pregnant. I'm not genetically related to anyone. It's not my child. So when this case comes before a judge, unlike philosophers who can say, this is a fascinating case. I wonder what the answer is. But I'm hungry and I'm going home. A judge has to actually render a decision. A judge can't just say, it's interesting, I don't know. So what does a judge do when there's no case law? There's nothing there. There's no previous information that the judge can base it on. So they turn to the philosopher's writings. So for this, we'll turn to what the philosophical's view, the philosopher's self, was the view of parenting. What are grounds for parenting? Now, the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy has a great entry, and the reason why I'm quoting from there is they take like 85-page articles and make it into one readable paragraph. So it's a lot easier. So they talk about the genetics model, and they talk about the gestational model. And even in the gestational model, there's some fascinating new work that Dr. John Loicki is doing about what actually the gestational mother contributes to the child, but we're not going to get into that. That can be a separate lecture, but it's a very fascinating aspect. But the third model that they put forth is something called the intentionality model. Essentially, what is the intentionality model? And the intentionalists argue that because they carefully and intentionally orchestrated the procreational act, bringing together all the necessary components with the intention of creating a unique individual whom they intend to raise as their own. Essentially, in normal speech, what they said is that parenthood no longer has to be a biological relationship. It can be a moral relationship. As long as I intend to create this child and I cause it to come and I help it come about, you're considered the parent. So according to the intentionalists, who would be the parents in the case of the Bezenkas? Right? It would be Mr. and Mrs. Bezenka. Not the other three people, but Mr. and Mrs. Bezenka. Since they were the people that intended and they caused it to come about, fine. The fourth model is that of the causality model. And the causality model states, basically, that if you cause the child to exist, that is sufficient rights for that's sufficient for generating parental rights and responsibilities over that child. In that case, who would, in the Bezenka case, who would be the parents? It would be all five of them. All five of them helped cause this child to come about. And therefore, according to this model, it would be all five parents would be considered parents, which is a wild idea. And what these principles did for me was it made me take a step back and made me think that maybe there's another dimension to parenthood that we haven't discussed in the halakhic aspect. Because essentially what these two models are talking about is social parenthood. It's a situation where the people that are raising the child are not genetically related. And it was this third dimension that I wanted to see if it had basis in halakha. Because if it does have basis in halakha, then every single time Chana comes to you and asks you this question, you have a very simple answer. And that's yes. So let's see if this actually does have any basis in halakha. So where would one turn to look for something, for social parenthood? Adoption literature. Now in American law, adoption actually allows you to do is it actually allows you to supplant the biological relationship. It basically completely replaces the biological relationship and you become the full parent with all its legal rights, responsibilities, and privileges. But in halakha, that's not necessarily true. We don't completely supplant the biological relationship. So let's see what exactly do we do. So the source, the beginning of the adoption literature starts from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. If you take a look here on page 3, two-thirds of the way down, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, "Lo amedcha shekol negadlu yosem b'soch beso malav akosav ki'ilu yolam." If you raise an orphan in your house, the Torah considers it as if you gave birth to him. Now that's a pretty powerful statement. But the question is this just a nice drush? Or does this actually have halachic ramifications? And for the rest of the lecture, I'd like to go on the journey with you that I had with my chavrusa, Rabbi Sinensky, when we researched this topic. So it starts with the Gemara in Kiddushin. The Gemara in Kiddushin is having a discussion, and Abayi refers to his mother. He says, "I'm really in. My mother said to me." And the Gemara asks, "Hold on one second. How can Abayi be quoting his mother? Abayi was an orphan. His father died before he was born. His mother died at birth. How on earth can he possibly be quoting his mother? How can he say his mother said to me?" And the Gemara answers, the reason why was because who is he quoting? So hahi miravinsehavi. He was quoting the person that raised him. Okay, so we see an idea that maybe the person that raised you, I can call you mother. But that doesn't necessarily tell me that I would grant you parental rights. So let's look a little further. The next page. So is there any place in the Torah that perhaps we can see that the Torah refers to someone who raises you as the parent? And there's a fascinating comment by the Ramban. The Ramban discussing Pasuk and Parshas Pinchas, which we'll read in a few weeks, commenting on the Pasuk, V'shem Bas Asher Sar. So the Ramban quotes an alternative text of the Targum Onkelos, that in fact, who was the father of Sarach? It was not Asher. In fact, the Ramban says, if you skip down to the underlined words, Aval Haisa Bas Ishto Mi Ish Acher. Sarach, according to this Ramban, was not actually biologically related to Asher, but in fact was his stepdaughter. And nevertheless, the Torah refers to him in a way as if Sarach is his daughter. Okay, that's a nice comment by the Ramban, but it doesn't necessarily convey that there's any halachic ramifications or any rights or privileges it would be granted to this to the person that raised them. So now we'll turn to the Gemara in Chulin. Gemara in Chulin has a fascinating discussion there. It's talking about Shiluach HaKein. And the din by Shiluach HaKein we know is that if you come across the nest and the nest has eggs and there's a mother bird on it, what are you required to do? Right, you're required to send away the mother bird before you take the eggs. So the Gemara asks, well, what if? The bird that's sitting on these eggs is not, in fact, the mother. As you can see here, I have a nice picture of a bird that clearly cannot be the mother of that egg, since it's much smaller than the egg. What if the Gemara says that you come across a bird that's sitting on eggs that don't belong to it? Would the din of Shiluach HaKein apply in that case? And the Gemara answers that if it's a kosher bird, yes. And Rashi says, why? You skip down to Rashi here, right next where he says, "Dehoil v'darkahu legadlan v'aim rovetes karina be." Since this bird is playing mother, is raising these eggs, is sitting on these eggs, it would have a din of Shiluach HaKein. Now again, while this might show some halachic ramification, this is in the animal kingdom. So is there anything in the human kingdom where we see halachic ramifications to someone who raises the child? So with this, we'll turn to the Ramah. And in the Shaias and Teshuvos of the Ramah was asked whether, it was asked by a stepson, can I say Kaddish for my stepfather? And I guess at the time it wasn't commonplace for people to say Kaddish for other people as it is nowadays. And because the Ramah wrote back to him and said yes, or told him yes. And he asked, no, please write it down so when people ask me, I'll be able to show you this permission slip, essentially. So we're seeing here at least the discussion in which we can refer to the person that raised you as a parent. But again, this doesn't have, this in itself is not any halakhic ramification. So now I'll turn to page 5. So the Ramah in Choshen Mishpat has a fascinating comment based on the Truest Maimon. And what's discussing here is contract law. So in a contract, right, if anyone's ever seen a ksuba, essentially it says the name of the person, the son of another person. So it would say Yonadav ben Shmuel. So the question that's asked in the Truest Maimon is, what if I use the name of some, not the person that's my birth father, but if I use the name of the father that raised me? In that case, would that still be a kosher shtah? And what does the Ramah say? Mishmegado yasam b'silch beso, the kasal of b'shtar b'ni. Oh, so that's where I refer to the person that I raised, that's my son. Oh hay yasam, or if the orphan himself, kasav al hamagadlo avi v'imo, lo mikri mizuif. The shtar would not be considered false. That would still be considered a good shtar. The fact that he wrote a different name than his biological parent does not invalidate the shtar. And where does the Gra refer to? The Gra says, where does he get this from? He refers us back to that original Gemara in Sanhedrin. And he says, this is from the Gemara in Sanhedrin that Mishmegad Yasin Sof Beso Malo of Akasiv Kilo Yod. Okay, so now we're starting to see this idea that maybe in halacha we can call the father, the person that raises you a father. But that still has not showed us anywhere in which we would grant parental rights or responsibilities in this case. And this leads me to a mind-blowing Chachma Shlomo. Rav Shlomo Kluger in the next source here, and I'll read it because you wouldn't believe me if I didn't read it inside. He says, "V'hine." And here he's discussing, Evan Ezra, he's discussing, can I be Mekayim the mitzvah of Puru Revu? Is it possible that maybe through raising an orphan in my house, I can be Mekayim the mitzvah of Puru Revu? Which is a pretty wild idea. And if in fact you can be Mekayim the mitzvah, that would be the first source where we see rights and responsibilities and privileges that are given to the person that raises you. So I'll read him inside. I'm not sure. If someone raises a yasam inside their house, in nashav zekiyim puruvu, can you mekayim mitzvah puruvu, the ultimate mitzvah in having a child? Right? Chazal said, if I raise a child in my house, it's as if I was born, if I gave birth to him. So does that mean that I'm a kind of mitzvah for Ruvu? And skip down to the next two words in from the next line. Ulchori says, Nira dizet toli beplugta hadrisha im hatas biyardeh. He says this apparently might be depends on the machlokas in the drisha and hatas. What's the machlokas in the drisha and hatas? So he says, the machlokas is, the dasa drisha, the drisha says, kol makom shenemar ki ilu, every time it says the word ki ilu, Ein hamukashava. It doesn't actually mean that they're equal. It just means it's similar. But it doesn't actually mean equal. However, according to the Taz, he says, "V'hataz cholek tushav emamish." It's actually, according to the Taz would say, no, when I say ke'ilu, it means actually ke'ilu. And if you skip down, to the next underlined segment, he spells this out. He says, therefore, avala hataz shehushav emamish, az yotzit ba yidei kru uruvim. According to the Rav Shlomo Kluger, he's saying that according to the Taz, you would in fact be yotzi the mitzvah of pru revu by merely raising the yasum in your house. This is a wild idea. However, this is brought down in halacha. So if you look at the Berachas Banim, the next source, Berachas Banim rips it apart. And he says, v'chol she'in ha'nolad mityaches l'molad. If you're not, if there's no biological relationship, lo kayim pru revu. You're not mekayim pru revu. And he says, ubevadei daito shalachach mashlomo, Rav Shlomo Kugar, he das yachid v'lo matzana b'poskim. This is ridiculous. It's not found in poskim. It's a das yachid. It's not lahalacha. And you would think that would be the end of it. However, the Tzitz Eliezer, in the next source, a very noted posik, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, who wrote proliferously on topics of medicine and halacha, and he was the chief rabbi in Shari Tzedek, and really has a tremendous amount that he's given to the medical halacha community, as well as many other halachic issues. So what does he say? So he says, if you look at the underlined area, hen yochlu l'kayim, yochlu l'kayim mitzvos pru revua yedei zeh, she'adam yegadol b'sof beis lo yasam ve'yosoma. Can I be mekayim the mitzvah of pru revu through raising this child? What is the answer? He says, "Shekvar Yashiv al Meduchazos Agon Rav Shlomo Kluger ba'Agasa l'Shulchan Aruch." He validates Rav Shlomo Kluger. He says, "Look at Rav Shlomo Kluger." So maybe it's not so far fetched like the Berachas Banim said. In fact, the Tzitz Eliezer is even saying, "No, Shlomo Kluger is not so far out there." This leads me to one of the final sources, and this is the Shmos Rabbah on the end of Perek Mimbar. And the Shmos Rabbah here is talking about a mashal and saying that Klal Yisrael's relationship to Hashem is like that of an adoptive parent who cares for the child. And what he says, and we'll skip down to the bolded, the second to last line that's bolded and underlined. Amru lo Rabbeinu Olam, Hamegadel Av Velo Hamolad. Who is considered the father in this case? If you have an adoptive parent, you have a yasam? Who's the father? Is it the birth father of the yasam? No. It is the megadel, the lo hamulet. That seems to be pretty straight up. My last source is from Rav Salavitcher. So if you might say to me, okay, maybe you twisted the Hebrew words, I'll show you the source in English. And this is from Rav Salavitcher in his essays, Family Redeemed. I'll skip down to the underlying area. He's talking about fertility and the struggles of an infertile couple. He says, the childless mother and father must reconcile themselves with the fact of natural barrenness and sterility. Yet, he says, they may attain the full covenantal experience of parenthood. And if you skip down to the next underlying words, and he says, this new form of parenthood does not conflict with the biological one, relation. It manifests itself as a new dimension which may be separated from the natural one. So what Soloveitchik is saying here is that in fact there are multi-dimensions to parenthood. There is both the biological relationship and the social relationship. And while it's debatable whether the intentionality model or the causality model actually have any basis in halacha, what those models did for me was help me take a step back, a step outside the so-called halachic box, and say, maybe I'm asking the wrong question. Maybe up until now, I've always been asking, who's the biological parent? And as soon as you ask that, then you're going to have to go down that path of, is it the birth mother, is it the genetic mother? And in the end, when Hannah comes to you, and as I said, she will, she's going to come to you with this question. How will you answer her desperate plea? And what we've seen today yields a new philosophical approach to parenting, on the nature of parenting, that there's two aspects. There's the biological aspect and the educational raising of the child. Meaning that the one who raises the child can be called the halachic mother. Now, it's important to realize that just like in other areas of law, where different models might have different rights and responsibilities, this model does not grant full rights and responsibilities to the parent. It does not make the parent the Yerusha. It does not change the Yichus. It does not change a lot of those things. But what it really does is it changes the psychological, the emotional issue. When Chana is standing before you, the answer that she wants, the answer she's waiting for you to say, is that this is her child. She needs this to be her child. That's what she wants. Nothing more in this world. She wants this to be her child. And now you are able to say to her, yes, this is your child. And I think that this humane, this compassionate and caring side really reflects who Dr. Weissman truly was. Thank you very much for coming.